By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater than the treasures of Egypt. The focus of the entire book of Exodus that we're in the midst of right now, right on the front end of our study, is a relationship, a covenant relationship between God and His people, us. And page after page, or story after story, as we look through this remarkable book, we see God revealing Himself. And we will, I hope and pray, continue to see Him revealing Himself to His people, initially to the original folks in the story here, and now to us, revealing Himself through signs, through wonders, making abundantly clear His sovereign majesty, as we'll see today, His holiness, His power, His glory, His righteousness, His compassion, His patience, time and again, God exposing and revealing Himself. And I suppose if we had a careful journal taken of our lives, it would appear just the same. If we were to accurately write up how God had dealt with us, that it would be described in the very same ways. That He's been sovereign in His majesty and His rule and His reign in our lives. That He's proven Himself holy and righteous and just. That He continues to get glory from Himself. And He's continued to show His people compassion and mercy. And He's patient towards us. Now, where we are in the midst of the story today, as you remember from last week, the people of God, the Israelites, have been in bondage for over 400 years. Now, at one time, the king in Egypt knew their kin, a man named Joseph. But all of those kings have died, and the new king doesn't know Joseph. And he's getting a little anxious about the size of the Israelites. Their number is becoming a worry for him. And so he imposes hard labor in an attempt to suppress them and keep them from multiplying at such great rates. But it doesn't do any good. In fact, they grow at a more rapid rate. So his second plan was to demand that the midwives who were helping the Hebrew women give birth, to murder all of the little boys, assuming then that the young Hebrew girls would just blend in with the Egyptians. That didn't work either. And so the command was given for all of the boys that are born among the Hebrews to be cast into the Nile. And it's in the midst of this situation that Moses is born. Born to a Hebrew girl, but ends up being bred by Pharaoh's court. And I began by reading what the writer of Hebrews says concerning Moses, that by faith, after he had grown up in the house of Pharaoh and he reached the age of 40, he no longer wanted to be the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He turned his back on all that was to offer, possibly even being Pharaoh himself one day. He turned his back on the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater than the abundant treasures that Egypt had to offer, because he was looking for the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. Now, we noticed last week the problem with that is that though Moses set out with faith, in faith, he attempted to do it in his own strength, initially at least. He set out with his own plan in mind. If you remember when he set out, he sees a Hebrew fighting an Egyptian. And he knows that his primary mission at this point is to rescue the Israelites from the Egyptians. And so he does just that. He kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. And that causes problems. In fact, Moses' antics on that day delayed the deliverance of God's people another 40 years. And it seems that towards the end of that 40 years that Moses has all but given up. Verse 22 of chapter 2, Moses' wife, Zipporah, gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom. I'm a sojourner in a foreign land. I'm living in a land that's not my own. I'm 80 years old. But that's not the end of the story. Fortunately, in the course of those many days, verse 23, another king died. Didn't prove any better hope for the Israelites. But what gave them hope was when they realized that there was no hope in anything other than crying out to God. They sighed, they groaned for help, and God heard them. God remembered the covenant that he had made with his people. God saw them and he took notice of them and their situation. And we ended last week with this wonderful picture of a prayer-hearing God who had heard the prayers of his people and took intimate notice of them, remembering the promises that he had made them to them from long ago. And even here, it's wonderful that the story doesn't stop. The first two chapters of Exodus that we looked at last week, 400 years, a span of 400 years is summarized there. The next 38 chapters, 1 year. So the pace is going to pick up as far as the action on the pages and what's happening in the next 38 chapters. The entire rest of the book, the year of their rescue. Right after God hears their prayers, the scene changes. Chapter 3, verse 1, Moses is minding his own business, doing what he's been doing for 40 years. And there's a bush that's on fire, which is not really all that big of a deal. It happened pretty often that acacia trees, for example, would be dry. The sun coming down on a rock, perhaps, would increase the heat, the intensity of the heat, and the acacia tree would burn. But even Moses himself says, this is why I'm looking. This is why I'm taking a quicker look. The bush was not consumed. I must turn aside now, verse 3, and see this marvelous sight. The marvelous sight is not the burning bush, but the marvelous thing is why the bush is not burned up. Now, as I mentioned, it's wonderfully encouraging that God hears us when we pray, that he remembers the covenant that he's made with us. But those things can theoretically happen from a distance, from far off. God sitting in the heavens, we might say, looking down and seeing what's going on among his people, hearing them. But here we have displayed for us in vivid actuality what it actually means for God to hear and remember and see and take notice. It's far more than a glance from on high in our direction. It's a lot more than a vague notion of our situation or some foggy idea of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. When God hears the cries of his people and he sees them in their distress, he doesn't stand back and merely hope for the best, assuming that they're going to be okay, raising up some leader that maybe he'll lead them and maybe he won't. Maybe he'll be a great leader. Maybe he'll be a failure. He doesn't just sit and feel compassion and pity from his throne room in heaven. Verse 8 makes clear what happens when God hears his people. He describes what he has done already here to Moses. I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians. God didn't stay on high, seated, watching, seeing the pity, sending help from there. But he came and planted himself right in the midst of his people in order to deliver them, to be their salvation. God came to bring them up from that land to a good land, a spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Now, in chapters 3 and 4, which we're going to make an attempt to look at today, we have this encounter between God and Moses, and we've opened up the scene already where God appears in a burning bush to Moses, and he begins a conversation with him. And here are the six things that I hope to cover, and I may not mention them again. That's why I'm going to give you my points now, so you won't lose the point in the end. Okay? God comes down. God calls Moses. God commissions Moses. God counters Moses' questions and objections. God clears up a major misconception that Moses has. And God reveals his concern for his people in the end. First, God comes down, and he comes down to rescue and deliver, as we've seen already. And it's almost impossible for us to get away from the overarching idea that God coming down in the midst of a burning bush to speak to Moses here is a wonderful picture of Christ himself coming down and living, taking the form of a man and living a life here on earth with one primary purpose: to save. You shall call his name Jesus. He will save his people from their sins. He came to rescue us. Now, verse 2 here says that it was an angel of the Lord who appeared to him. And I suppose we could go round and round arguing and discussing the possibilities of, is this an angel? What type of messenger is it? Is it God himself? Is it the God-man? A pre-incarnate Christ. A Christophany, it would be called. I will mention that Gregory of Nyssa, in the late 300s, suggested that Moses saw the transcendent essence and cause of the universe on which everything depends and alone subsists. Succinctly, what Gregory of Nyssa said, Moses saw Jesus. The writer of Hebrews seemed to think the same thing, seeing him who was unseen. He pressed on in faith. And if we note that when this messenger of God, as he's called here, when he speaks to Moses, he doesn't speak for God, but he speaks as God. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. I have seen the affliction of my people. Whether or not it's Christ appearing to Moses here in the bush, one thing is certain. Moses stands in the presence of God. There's no argument with that. Moses is standing in the presence of a holy God. And when God comes down, he immediately calls to Moses. Moses, Moses. Don't come near here. Take your sandals off. You're standing on holy ground. Now, there was nothing any different than in the dirt itself, the moments before the bush was burning and the moments after. But the holiness of God demands reverence. And the authority of God demands submission from Moses and servanthood. And the remembrance of God, when Moses realizes this is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, this is the God of my fathers, it produces a holy, reverential fear in Moses. And he says, here I am. Which is a common theme throughout scriptures when God calls out to his own. Here I am, Samuel, in the middle of the night. Here I am, Isaiah, when God is looking for someone and tells Isaiah who's going to go. Ask Isaiah, who's going to go for me? Isaiah answers, here I am, send me. The same idea is included in Moses' answer here. "Here I am at your service." Having removed his sandals, which was very common among the slaves and the servants in those days as a way of showing respect and reverence. And here at this point in the story, our portion of the story this morning, everything looks very good because Moses has responded. He's ready for his orders. But that's just the problem. Moses has no idea, it seems, what God wants from him. And this begins to be unfolded as God commissions Moses, beginning in verse 10. "Come now, Moses, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." Now, this is an ever amazing paradox. That God would use sinners like Moses, like you. That he would use sinners to carry out his saving purposes and his plans for redeeming a people for himself. I mean, and here God is using Moses, who himself was rescued in quite an amazing fashion from being born as a Hebrew child, hidden in the closet for 3 months, put in the edge of the Nile so the daughter of Pharaoh would find him, raised up in Pharaoh's court. Moses himself was rescued in an amazing way. And now God is saying, "I'm going to send you, Moses, to rescue the people of God." I mean, I find this true as we read through Scripture and as we look throughout history, that God often uses uncommon faithfulness of very common people. Moses isn't so convinced that that's the case, and he begins right in the very next verse, countering, objecting, questioning God. Look at verse 11. "Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?'" I mean, granted, it's one man versus a superpower, okay? The strongest place in the nation. We can understand a little bit why Moses would feel this way. But Moses still, in light of this reality, is asking the wrong question. I mean, just look at how self-centered it is. Who am I? Moses has identity issues, no doubt, massive insecurities. He's chronically uncertain about himself. He's experiencing overwhelming uncertainties concerning the times. He's already tried this before. You remember what happened last time? He went out of control, killed the Egyptian, and delayed this thing 40 years. He's an old man now. I don't think we have anybody close to 80. I can get away with that. So, okay, he's 80 now. He's more mature, wiser, but he feels his personal inadequacy. So there's identity issues, but it's not just identity issues. It's not just an identity-based question here that Moses is asking, but it's a practical one too. He doubts his ability. How am I, Moses, going to rescue the people of God from this superpower? As I mentioned, the history of his attempts was not good. He was an Ophir. But fortunately for Moses, in Moses' case, and fortunately for us as well, it doesn't really matter who we are, as long as God is with us. And that's the exact answer that God gives. Moses says, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh?" And God says, "I will be with you." And that should be enough. It's important for us to notice that God doesn't promise to transform Moses into someone else. He doesn't promise to give Moses any kind of special powers. He doesn't promise to make Moses someone who's more capable, with more courage, more up to the task at hand. He simply promises to go with him. And that would be sufficient. Again, this is a theme that we find running throughout the Scriptures. After Moses has died and Joshua has taken command, God says to him, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. And if it isn't good enough for God to make this promise to Moses and then to Joshua, what about our Lord standing final words before he departs and goes and sits enthroned on high, awaiting the consummation of the kingdom, says this, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Moses wasn't given anything that you haven't been given. All that Moses was given to accomplish the rest, for the rest of his life, the task that God had given him, you too have been granted these things. I mean, think about Moses' preparation up until this point. God had prepared Moses in Pharaoh's courts for 40 years. He was Egyptian enough to confront the Egyptian Pharaoh. God had added 40 years of shepherding experience to Moses' life. He was born a Hebrew. He was Hebrew enough to love the Hebrews. And again, it's not very far stretched for us to see a wonderful type here in Moses. Egyptian enough to deal with the Egyptians. Hebrew enough to love the Hebrews. Christ was God and he could deal with God on our behalf. And he was man so he could deal with us. For God taking on the sin of the world, dying, yet being God, death could not hold him in the grave. But though Moses had these remarkable credentials from our perspective, God doesn't pull out this resume and say, look, Moses, this is who you are. This is who I've made you. I've accomplished all this in you so that you can have your time to shine now. God doesn't go out of his way at all to try to prove to Moses that he's the right man for the job. He simply says this, I'll be with you. I wonder if that's enough for us, that God would be with us, whatever he's called us to do. The Exodus, the redemption, the rescue that God has planned would not depend on the capability of Moses, but on the presence of God. I will be with you. Not only that, let's continue there in the reading. Verse 12. Certainly I'll be with you, God has said to Moses, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Now that's an interesting point for God to make, because Moses had to believe what God was saying here by faith. I mean, what an odd sign. Moses, you are going to be sufficient for the task because I'm going with you. And oh yeah, by the way, in the end, I'm going to meet you and my people there at the mountain and we're going to worship. The sign is offered as a future promise. It had to be received by faith. And you have to think that that's what the writer of the Hebrews in the New Testament was talking about when he said he was looking to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king. He endured seeing him who is unseen. Another wonderful note here for us to take to heart is that the primary plan of God for the people in the days of the Exodus was not merely to lead his people out of Egypt, but the primary plan was to gather his people to himself. And it's the same for us. God's plan for you isn't merely to save you from anything. He will save his people from their sins, you may say. Yes, but why? Because sin's your great problem that keeps you from coming to God, which is what you're created for. And that's what God is doing, is gathering the people for himself, around himself, to worship him and enjoy him forever. He's accomplishing that even now. And we see this even in the days of the Exodus. God's design isn't merely to take them out of this foreign land, but his design is to bring his people around himself to create a kingdom of people that love him and worship him. In light of this wonderful statement from God, Moses continues with his query. Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I'll say to them, Moses says, this is chapter 3, verse 13, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now, they may say to me, what is his name? And if they say, what is his name, what shall I say to them? God says, Moses, I am who I am. Why don't you just tell them, I am sent you to them? I am. Simply that. What's in a name? Descriptions, definitions, associations. We know that. Even when we think about names, certain things come to our mind. When we're naming our children, we think about the names, whether it's a name that we like or a name that's associated with family or something else that we want to associate a name with. So it's obvious to us that there are many things that are revealed here in this name, the I am. And there's really more included here than we can begin to unfold. And we use this passage, you may remember, when we talked about the self-existent, self-dependent, self-sufficient God at some point last fall. We used this passage primarily. And we see here, wrapped up in this name, the I am, God is self-existent. He relies on nothing else for his existence. He's self-dependent. He's dependent on nothing for anything. He's self-sufficient. He needs nothing at any time from anyone in any place, nor will he ever. He alone is the uncaused cause. He's the only uncaused cause. He has no origin, no beginning, no end. He's always existed, and his existence depends on nothing outside of himself. And he's so self-existent, and because he's created everything, everything else on the face of the planet and in the universe and beyond is dependent on him for its very existence. Creatures like you, like me, we have a derived existence, a dependent existence, but not God. He is as self-existent as he is self-dependent. Self-existent, self-dependent, self-sufficient, I am. God's basically just given Moses a quick answer. This is who I am, Moses. Do you have any more questions? Before Moses has a chance to ask more questions, and he will, God continues. Furthermore, verse 15, you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. Go, gather the elders of Israel together and say to them that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has appeared to me saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you. So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders will come to the Pharaoh and say to him, God has met with us. Please let us go and worship. And God gives a few details of how that's going to happen. He's not going to listen to you. I mean, Moses knows from the outset. God's going to harden his heart, and it's going to take God being firm and using compulsion to allow Pharaoh to actually let the people go. And even with this promise of how things are going to happen, even some specific details unveiled here, still when we get to chapter 4, Moses says on the back end of this great promise, okay, right, God has just said, you will plunder the Egyptians. And Moses says, what if they won't believe me? What if they won't listen to what I say? And the Lord, so patient, so kind, doesn't crush Moses or say, what are you thinking? But he says, what's that in your hand? Oh, it's my staff. I'm a shepherd. Throw it on the ground and it becomes a serpent. The kind of serpent that Moses is quite afraid of because he backs up. And then God says, why don't you grab a hold of its tail? Which is never where you grab a poisonous snake. Why don't you just grab it by its tail, Moses? And he does, and it turns right back into a staff. And if that's not enough, Moses, why don't you take your hand and put it inside your cloak and pull it back out? And it was covered with leprosy. And if that's not enough, the last thing you would ever do if you had leprosy on your hand is put it close to your body, and he tells him to put it back there again. And Moses does. And when he pulls it out, it's clean. And if the second sign's not enough, Moses, why don't you take some of the Nile, which is the source of life in all of Egypt, why don't you take it up in a cup and pour it on the dry land and watch it turn to blood? God transforms the staff to the serpent. He renews the leprous hand to a clean hand. And he conquers by turning the Nile from water into blood. Now, a bit further on the idea of the leprosy. You see, the people of God, the Hebrews, the Israelites, they needed more than to merely be rescued from their slavery. So God gives a bit of more detail here with the sign of what he's accomplishing. He's not merely going in trying to move the people from this land to that land. There's more involved than that. They needed to be cured from their sin that kept them far off. And God here is proving that he has the power to forgive sin, to cleanse their leprous, spiritually leprous hearts so that they might come into his presence and worship him. After these remarkable signs, Moses is right back to his same old tricks. Verse 10 of chapter 4. Please, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. Moses is complaining to God about God making him a stutterer. Or slow to speak. He's not just commenting to God, describing to God what the problems are. Moses knows who God is and that God is the creator. And he's accusing God. God, you're calling me to do something that you haven't provided for. If you wanted me to go and talk to Pharaoh, if you wanted me to go and convince all of the Hebrew children that I was their leader, then you should have given me a better ability with my mouth. You shouldn't have given me this slow, stammering tongue. According to Moses, it was God's fault that Moses couldn't do what God himself had called him to do. As if God had missed the memo along the way that Moses needed to be able to speak a little more clearly. And God answers Moses here with a rhetorical question. Verse 11. Who made man's mouth, Moses? Who makes man mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I'll be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what to say. God wasn't really concerned about Moses' inability. Not in the slightest. He's not real concerned about what you think is your inability. John Bunyan was an uneducated tinker, a tinsmith. He just fashioned things out of metal. A.W. Pink, concerning John Bunyan, said this, God has used the simple language of unlettered Bunyan, meaning Bunyan didn't have letters after his name, far more than he has the polished writings of thousands of university graduates. John Owen, one of the greatest Puritan minds ever, heard John Bunyan preach one time. Charles II heard that John Owen had been to hear the tinker preach. And he asked Dr. John Owen why he would want to hear a mere tinker preach. And Owen replied in this way, "May it please your majesty, If I could possess the tinker's abilities to grip men's hearts, I would gladly give in exchange all my learning. God has created you exactly the way He wants you. And He can use you just the way that He's made you. He hasn't made some mistake with the way that He's fashioned you and what He's called you to do. In fact, He's been very intentional in the way that He's accomplished that. Moses has questioned God four times now. And he's still not done. Verse 13. Moses says, "Please, Lord, send the message by whomever you will." Translated, God, please send somebody else. Please. God's promised to go with him, to go before him. He's guaranteed the outcome, promised that they will worship on the mountain in the end, that the Egyptians will be plundered, that he has the power to transform, to heal, to renew, to conquer, that he'll be his mouth and give him the words to say. And still Moses says, "You've got to send someone else." As you can imagine, the patience hasn't run out, but it is running thin. Look at verse 14. "The anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, 'Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he speaks fluently, and moreover, behold, he's coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart. You're to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and he will be as a mouth for you, and you will be as God to him. You shall take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs." Moses' final attempt here, he says what he's really been thinking and feeling all along: "God, I just don't want to do it. I would rather you just send someone else. I'm not up to it." He's insecure. He's uncertain. He's unprepared. He's unworthy. He's inadequate. He's unable. He's incompetent. He's ineffective. He's not eloquent. He's unwilling. The initial response from Moses after receiving this commission from God was this: "I can't. Therefore, I won't." But after the Lord's dealings with him, patiently, kindly dealing with him and answering every question that he's had, he's no longer at the point of "I can't, therefore I won't." But here it's "I can't, but God can, therefore I will." And God then begins to spell out how he's going to provide using Aaron, his brother. But it's important for us to note, even at this point in the story, it's not the incompetence of Moses any more than it is the competence of Aaron that's going to accomplish the Lord's plans. But it is the wonderful presence of God himself. And after God has told Moses exactly how it's going to happen now, using his brother Aaron, Moses goes back to Jethro, verses 18 and following, and says, "Please let me go, that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they're still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons, mounted them on a donkey, returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. Just three verses here about Moses going back to Jethro. But they're an important three verses, because it's irresponsible for us to think that once we're convinced of a particular idea or notion that is God's call to us, that we can just go off and abandon all of our existing commitments without any reference to others. I mean, don't you think Moses would have been justified just to head off to Egypt and say, "God's called me. This is what I'm going to do"? I mean, I questioned him over and over, and he convinced me overwhelmingly that this is what I'm supposed to do. And so he should just head off to Egypt. But he doesn't do that. He goes back to his father-in-law, who is, by the way, his employer, and says, ask permission. Now, it's interesting to note exactly what he asked. He's going back to see if they're alive. Now, of course they're alive. God has said that he's going to rescue them. Which I think we could describe as courteous discretion within the bounds of truth. Okay, Moses was practicing. He's taking his daughter and his grandkids. He's not saying, hey, we're going to go up against the biggest superpower in the world. It's quite likely that Moses is being wise here. It's also likely that Jethro knew exactly what was going on. Later in the book of Exodus, we'll see Jethro offering Moses wonderful advice and counsel. Also of note, the end of verse 20. This staff that was just a staff has now become the staff of God. It's no longer Moses' staff that he carried around in the days of shepherding. I mean, it's the same stick, theoretically. But it's become the staff of God. It's become the sign that God is with him, that the power of God is going before him. In verse 21, the Lord said to Moses, when you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I've put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go that he may serve me. But you refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn. Play by play of the coming weeks. I mean, that's what we see here. Not filling in the details on the calendar as much, but revealing the overall trajectory of what God's plan is for the coming weeks, for Moses and for his people and for the Egyptians as well. And then verse 24 through 26. Now it came about, okay, they're traveling now from Midian on to Egypt. It came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, you are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me. So he let him alone. At that time, she said, you are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. The Lord sought to put Moses to death. After this incredible encounter that we've just read about, Moses, you're going to go and lead my people out of bondage and gather together on the mountain. Moses says, no, not me. And with overwhelming convincing, God overwhelmingly convinces Moses, yes, you are. And now he's finally done what he's supposed to do. And he's on the way there. And God is so angry with him that he wants to put him to death. What is going on? This is that point I mentioned in the beginning. I think this is number 5, and it's the first time that I've told you which point I'm on. God clears up a major misconception. Or we could title it this, First Things First. Noting that diligence, due diligence is required in all of our dealings. You see, what's happened here is obvious. And Zipporah has the insight. You remember last week we looked at the irony of Pharaoh trying to get rid of all of the little boys, all of the men. And it was the ladies and the girls who had been used time and time again to carry out the plan of God. And here again, Zipporah realizes what's going on. I know why God's trying to kill Moses. I know what the problem is. Moses has failed to be obedient to what God has commanded him to do in circumcising his son. I'm an Egyptian, maybe he thought. I wasn't living in the land of Israel during that time. Nonetheless, he was commanded by God for his children to be brought in to the covenant family through the physical act of circumcision. And Moses was disobedient. And Zipporah realizes what's going on, takes the flint into her hands, does the deed herself, makes sure that the blood gets on Moses so that he can somehow be credited with the obedience of his wife, and then everything's okay. He's on his deathbed 1 minute, and all of a sudden he's okay as a result of the obedience. Now, it would be wonderful if we could say that this is the last time that Moses suffered from this reality of being disobedient and not being fully obedient to what God has said. But it happened again. In fact, disobedience was the ruin of Moses in the end. There, when they come to the rock, Moses' sister died. Numbers chapter 20. Miriam dies. Moses is probably feeling the weight of that grief and sorrow. The people are complaining about what to eat and what to drink, and there aren't any pomegranates or figs. There's not any food around here. Why have you brought us here? Moses and Aaron slip away. They meet with God. God says, take your staff in your hand and go speak to the rock. Do you remember what Moses said to the people? Let's pick up reading verse 8 of Numbers 20. Take the rod, God says, and you and your brother Aaron assemble the congregation. Speak to the rock before their eyes that it may yield its water. You shall thus bring forth water for them out of the rock and let the congregation and their beasts drink. So Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as he had commanded him. And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, listen now, you rebels. Shall we bring forth water for you out of this rock? Then Moses lifted his hand, struck the rock twice, and water came out. And the congregation and their beasts drank, and all seems well. If we could stop reading. God said to Moses, because you have not believed me, you have not treated me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I've given them. And Moses, because of his failure to listen and obey, is not allowed to enter in to the promised land. And he dies not long after that. He didn't learn his lesson here in the beginning, that God was patient with him in teaching. Right after this story, let's pick up reading verse 27 to the end. Now the Lord said to Aaron, go to meet Moses in the wilderness. So he went and met him at the mountain of God and kissed him. Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. God revealing again the concern that he has for his people. By meeting with them, first Aaron meets with the Lord, then Moses meets with Aaron, then Moses and Aaron are meeting with the leaders of Israel, then the Lord is coming near and meeting with his people. And it's the same up until today. Time and again, people have gathered together in the name of the Lord to worship him, to look at him and who he is, to consider the kindness that he's shown them. And to worship him. God had called Moses to a seemingly impossible task, and he had tried every way imaginable to get away from it. And he almost escaped having to do it as a result of his own disobedience. But I wonder if it crosses our mind that Moses' disobedience in the circumcision issue put the entire nation of Israel on the line. I wonder if you've considered those areas in your life where obedience isn't taken seriously. That salvation of souls is on the line. That people being rescued from bondage is at stake. You might say that God has called every single one of us with two separate callings. He's called all of his children, one, to be children, and two, to some type of service. And whatever he's called you to, whatever the task, he will equip you. What was true for Moses is true for you. You have the same promise. I will be with you always, even to the end of the age. That day hasn't come. Christ himself, I've got to go away. I'll send another comforter. It's to your advantage that I go away. He will be with you. You'll accomplish even greater things. We're amazed at the things that Moses is doing here in the story. We don't see things like that. It's not those kinds of things that we need. That's not the battle we're fighting. We're not trying to lead a host out of Egypt. Our goal is to hear, to listen, to obey, believing him that he will equip us, that he will guide us, and that he will go with us. What was true for Moses in the opening chapters of Exodus is true for every one of us. We serve a God who goes with us, a God who is self-existing, self-sustaining, and independent, who makes promises with his people and keeps every single one of them. A God who is victorious in all that he does. A God who transforms lives and situations for the good of his people and the glory of his Son. A God who is superior to every foe. A God who is superior to all opposition. A God who is the creator of all things and sustains them by the word of his power. A God who, when he calls you, is primarily calling you to simply this: to trust him. I mean, that's what happened with the people of Israel here. After all of the back and forth bantering, if you will, that Moses has with God, why me? What if they ask this question? Well, what about that? What am I going to say to them? What if they don't believe me? What about my incapability? In all of that, it comes down to these last few verses. No one else argued. They went to the people of God. Moses was so convinced that he'd had a word from God. Finally, he told Aaron what to say. Aaron tells the people. Not one of them has an argument. They believed. And as a result of their belief, they bowed low and they worshiped. And that's the life that we're called to simply believe what God has said. And if we believe what he said about himself and about us, then the result will be evidenced by us bowing low, living humbly, and worshiping him. Not only with our lips at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, but with our lives, every moment, every day. May God help us to this end. To not be so self-centered that we're questioning everything that God has said. His will is revealed wonderfully in his word. May he give us grace to, by faith, accept it, believe it, bow low, and worship him with our whole lives. Let's pray.